and just trade in your own name. Of course, international commerce would collapse if that were the case, because the whole structure is based on limited liability. So in brief, I would say, if it's a corporation, if it's a foundation, if it's a creature which is created by state legislation and maintained in existence by the will of the state, then privacy can be too much of a price for the people to pay. Corporate privacy, no problem. Let's scrap it. Personal privacy, big problem. And that's a philosophical debate for the next 5 years or 10 years.
And we can't afford another decade to win the argument for public registers for trusts. For as long as we only tackle anonymous ownership with registers for companies but not for trusts and foundations, this beneficial ownership avoidance game, this dash for new escape vehicles, will continue. As they say, sunlight is the best disinfectant. You've been listening to the TaxCast. That's it for now. We'll be back next month.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
This is APNS Public Radio.
The opinions expressed in dispatches represent the analysis of the participating editors and may not necessarily reflect the group positions of the ANG or its public news wires.
I think Angry Indian is one of those people who likes to walk up to two guys and say, let's see you and him fight.
This is the Angry Indian, and welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service. We have Malachi Daniels in the studio. It's been quite a while since I've spoken to this brother. Some of you might remember the debate that we had on black relationships. That was probably one of our most debated, our most listened, our most downloaded episodes. I got more feedback about that than most of the other things here that we talk about. Brother Daniels, as always, comes at you straight, no chaser, and there's no worrying about. And I'm not trying to be offensive in any sensitive way, but, you know, I can speak with him because we're not particularly worried about what white folks are concerned with. And it's actually refreshing because, you know, in the age of Trump, somewhat as in the age of Obama, you know, we've been somewhat limited in what we see as free speech and so on. You know, I mean, there was a whole lot of talk about holding Brother Obama's feet to the fire, quote unquote. You know, this was the white liberal chant before the election, right? And then 2008 came and passed, and they never actually held his feet to the fire about very much. And, you know, I shouldn't have to preface anything like this, but I think I'm pretty positive towards the, gay and lesbian community, transgender community, questioning community, bisexual community. You know, I shouldn't have to wave a flag about that. You know, I've talked about losing a family member and a couple of friends to homophobia. I shouldn't have to do that. But I also shouldn't be come down upon for pointing out that the Obama administration has stuck up more for white gay people. And I'm saying it like that because you've had how many transgender people who were murdered last year, and you've already had at least one recorded murder this year. And the overwhelming ethnicity of these victims are Africans in America. And the black community doesn't really say anything, you know. because we're dealing with a conundrum that's kind of ugly, because the majority of their assailants are African American, right? So, you know, I'm looking at this in which the way the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense looked at it, which is why you really don't hear a whole lot about the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense anymore, because you have to start looking at the contradictions within your own group. We have to look at the black people who supported Trump. We have to ask ourselves why someone like Azalea Banks would support a Donald Trump. Go look it up. Don't believe me. We have to ask ourselves why black people, when we're in crowds of other non-whites, why we are still looked down upon. No matter what we look like on the outside, I can vouch for this. No matter what we look like on the outside, do more to push what is considered a black liberationist motherfucking agenda than a lot of the cats that are out here riffing and making videos and talking a whole lot of crap. You know, even in Chicago, who has now hooked up with Scientology. See, we're going to talk about the contradictions because I have an opportunity to actually talk about those contradictions with someone who asked the same questions that I do, that I hope you would. Brother Malachi Daniels, welcome the fuck back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me back, brother. It's been a long time. We've been talking about this, getting back on the show for a while. But thank you.
Yeah, man. So, you know, a whole lot has happened. And I don't know really where to start. So we can start at the very basis. Since we've spoken, we've watched not so much that Trump got elected. I'm not surprised about this. You're not surprised about this. I don't particularly participate within the electoral process, and I think I've been vindicated in that argument. I've written about it, and I think this election vindicated everything. You have 2.9 some odd million goddamn votes for the institutional candidate on the Democratic National ticket, and then you have white women who have been completely disrespected by this grab the pussy guy. They overwhelmingly vote for this son of a bitch. And then you got a handful of house Negroes, you know, who go out of their way to stump for this person. You got Omarosa and whatever the hell that other chica was who, Pearson, you know, Katrina Pearson, what have you, you know. It's been a while since we've been together, man, but, you know, your thoughts.
Oh, brother. As we discussed off air, I've been kind of traveling a bit, much of it has to basically take some time, you hear the term thrown around quite a bit, self-care. I've definitely been through quite a bit in the past 10 years, and hopefully, and I've mentioned this to you in the past, hopefully at some point we can have a discussion on how the counterintelligence program has transformed and evolved over the years and what the current state of it is, because I think there are many people out there who are dealing with that current iteration of COINTELPRO. I think even some of them are involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. I would even say that some of them may even be on the conservative side of things as well. But I've been dealing with some of those things. And so I took some time out to actually try to, put myself in a space where I can, take care of, kind of physical things, but also reflect on politics as well. And, because I, don't want my politics to become stagnant and, so I, took some time out to do those things and reflect because, obviously, as you were just saying, so much has happened and so much is happening very quickly. And, some of the, forces who've been fighting for some time, on the revolutionary left and on the liberal left, it's been shown many of us are quite stagnant. And the fact that folks were blindsided by this victory of Trump shows how stagnant many of us have become. And I think it's very important for us to be able to take that kind of criticism, as well as, you know, get in people's asses about supporting this maniac.
Yeah, you know, I mean, at the least, I mean, I'm looking at, was it Bossip here? This is coming in right now. It's what, 8 hours ago? A2. Chrisette Michelle is performing at Trump's inauguration and people are pissed. I mean, my wife, you know, one of the things that she does pay attention to is pop culture. And she was very keen to come home and tell me that Jennifer Holliday had backed out, then whatever the hell they were called, they backed out. So he still got Lynn Greenwood and what the fuck else, Travis Tritt or whatever the fuck to perform there. But they've been trying to give away tickets. They got trolls on Twitter now that are trying to give away tickets because they can't get anybody there. Nobody wants to fucking be involved in this shit, you know?
Right, exactly. And well, someone just remarked to me that a friend of theirs who's, you know, he's very involved in well-known in the New York City house music community and, you know, cultural circles had been invited to the inauguration to make a little bit of money. And the only thing that turned him away was Snoop Dogg's video embarrassing conservative blacks about showing up to support Trump. And so my response was, really? It took Snoop Dogg shaming people for this black man to decide that he shouldn't be a part of this this inauguration. So it's amazing, man, the cognitive dissonance that is going on with, you know, not only black people, Latinos, you know, white liberals, you know, who have thrown their support behind this man. And I know, and I can hear it in your voice. You know, you're trying to wrap your mind around it.
All of this is maddening. You know, I can't believe, like I said, you know, I always knew that Steve Harvey was an assimilationist motherfucker anyway, from the get. So I'm not really surprised that when he got some kind of a phone call from somebody like that, he looked over and, you know, whoever he was in bed with and said, I finally got it. I got over that golden arch. I got a connection to the White House. Baby, we there. Right? And, you know, it doesn't matter who was in. I got the call. Now, I don't know if he was part of that clutch that Obama took to try to get the Olympics brought to Chicago that time. You remember that? I know Oprah Winfrey was in that.
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, she was in that crowd and whoever the hell else. I mean, they were mostly entertainers and such and so on. And Mark Lamont Hill, who, you know, you get a lot of people on the street. Oh, man, he's just an assimilationist motherfucker. It's like, well, you know, whatever. You say the same shit about me, you know. At least he's out there challenging these motherfuckers because, you know, they give him a platform. I mean, now probably it's just entertainment for Fox News to have him up there, or MSNBC, or whoever the fuck else. But at least he takes the fucking, you know, he takes that opportunity to challenge these motherfuckers. And he says, look, you know, the only reason we have such and such going on is because, you know, somebody like Steve Harvey is going to answer that call because Steve Harvey wants to seat at the table. The video was out there. You know, and of course I'm paraphrasing because, you know, some neo-Nazi, quote-unquote, alt-right motherfucker will listen to this shit and do go through 3 hours trying to, you know, deconstruct what the fuck I just said and how it leads to some sort of conspiracy against white people. No. He said that, you know, Steve Harvey wants a seat at the table, but Steve Harvey is an entertainer. And brother, I think you can confirm this for me. You know, people like to quote Malcolm X, but they don't like to do Malcolm X. Malcolm X said, this is the type of shit that we need to be fucking criticizing. You know, we bring up people who have horn. You know, I mean, who play horn. We bring up, you know, comedians and what have you. Which is not to say that people like Dick Gregory haven't done anything for the community, but we're not bringing our best goddamn intellectual minds up there. Steve Harvey is a fucking entertainer. And he pointed it out. He says, hey, unless he's become some sort of, you know, wizard in how to deal with fucking housing in the United States and how that shit relates to black people, other than perhaps his having grown up like that, what is the fucking relevance of his being there?
I'm going to, you know, piggyback on what you were saying. You know, not only is Steve Harvey an entertainer, but Steve Harvey is the worst kind of unprincipled entertainer. You know, Steve Harvey is very clearly, you know, even in his material years ago, you know, many people, you know, of his group were very keen on saying, listen, I'm, you know, white folks, I'm just looking for an opportunity, you know, because the moment I get an opportunity, I'm leaving the chiclet circuit behind, you know, just please offer me, you know, a sitcom, you know, a door in to, you know, white legitimacy, and I'll take it. I'll say anything. I'll do anything. And I think pretty much Steve Harvey's behavior over the years and many from his circle and his set have proven that they will do anything. They will say anything. It doesn't matter, you know, outside of, you know, something against their own mother, you know, which I honestly question if they would, you know, take some money to off their own mama, you know, because that's what an opportunist does. An opportunist will do and say anything to get ahead.
Yeah. You know, in a lot of ways, we can say the same thing about Obama. You know, I mean, we have had conversations, you know, here in Portland about what if Sister Michelle was president as opposed to him.
Right.
Because, you know, obviously she seems to have, and I'm not just saying this because she's Gullah and I'm Gullah, you know, but she just had a little more fucking, you know, gumption in terms of, you know, dealing with shit, at least in terms of being out there. What was going on with the Obama administration to say that they will never have another first family like this?
Oh, I absolutely. Listen, you know, the Obamas gave us, you know, that, you know, that illustrious, you know, those of us who remember the Cosby Show, you know, it gave black people of our generation the warm fuzzies to see that beautiful black family come out onto the White House lawn and show up and, you know, do whatever. But I've made it clear to black people and pissed them off by this. I'm like, listen, as fine as I think Michelle Obama is and as powerful as I think she is, I would put her in a cell right next to her husband. And the little sisters, you know, they'd have to go, you know, serve free breakfast and lunch for the kids.
Yeah, it's a chaotic mindfuck in a lot of ways because, you know, here we got Clinton, who I remember, and, you know, a lot of white people around me had a hard time hearing this from me. And, you know, a few of them, you know, were actually quite offended. I said, look, I had to deal with the fact that she was out there saying that, you know, we were, you know, motherfucking super predators.
Right.
And they're like, well, that was a long time ago. I said, no. I said, the cops actually said that to us. You know, I remember being, you know, stopped coming home from fucking school. And, you know, I wasn't the only one. I mean, they had a bunch of us standing there and they, you know, went through our bags and shit. And fucking.
Right.
I'm like, I don't, you know, why are you doing this? And they said, well, they sell a lot of drugs around here. And I'm like, but I don't fucking sell drugs. I don't even fuck with anything like that. And they're like, well, when you get your neighbors to stop doing this type of shit, then we'll leave you alone. You know? And it's a lot of fucking bullshit. You know, you're telling me to go out there and tell these motherfuckers to stop the drugs. Okay, once I do that,
and then they start coming after me, and then I come to you for fucking help. You use me as a motherfucking pawn to do what? And then we end up finding out that you're getting paid by these motherfuckers, right? You know, it's a vicious circle of bullshit. But, you know, it's just, you know, a lot of excuses for, you know, well, you're doing bad, so we're not going to blame the system. We're going to blame the victim. And if we got to come down on the normal citizenry who is just trying to get through, you know, it's really hard to explain to a lot of white folks that when you are trying to do the quote unquote, you know, right thing, and you live in the goddamn ghetto, you know, the fucking pressure is to get out of your, you know, get out of your door, get on the bus or whatever, you know, whatever type of public transport you take to get to your job, and then have to deal with the white world where you're supposed to be race neutral and all this type of shit, and deal with a lot of motherfucking disrespect and a lot of just, you know, inhumanity in a lot of fucking subtle ways. And then you got to get back on that public transport and then get back to your fucked up neighborhood and keep your fucking sanity.
Exactly.
You know, and it's not even just that, you know, that even that one goddamn aspect. You know, the entire fucking thing is, okay, people are asking me, well, why are you not upset that Trump, you know, got in? I'm like, why do you think I'm not upset? They're like, well, you're not angry. I'm like, what are you talking about? I said, what makes you think I'm going to be treated any you know, worse, really, than what's happening? I mean, you know, things are going to change, but if y'all, you know, had fucking had a different opinion in terms of politics in general, and in terms of fucking standing up to this bullshit before the fucking elections come up, maybe we would have had a different fucking, you know, outcome. I mean, you're in Seattle right now, right?
Right, correct.
So you're going to have a whole lot of, you know, women, because there's a lot of people leaving Portland, even though there's going to be a whole lot of shit happening here. They're going to be going up to, you know, Seattle to attend the massive women's protest, I believe, is happening next Saturday.
I've heard about it.
You've heard about it, right? Yeah. I mean, it's going to be all over the city, the downtown area. I assume around Westlake or what have you, for those of you who know the city of Seattle. I'm all for it. But see, I just heard that the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, they showed up with Avenger missile launchers there. And when the native people are like, you know, the protesters are like, what the fuck, you know, the water defenders, I should correct myself, they're like, what the fuck are you doing with something like that there? Because a lot of people seem to forget how many goddamn Native Americans serve in the motherfucking U.S. military in all goddamn branches. Really fucking disgusts me that people don't realize how many fucking Natives serve in the motherfucking Marine Corps, serve in the goddamn United States Army, serve in the motherfucking United States Navy, fucking Coast Guard, fucking Air Force, you know. I mean, goddamn. So you don't think they're going to recognize a fucking missile launcher when they see it? They dealt with that shit on their goddamn jobs. In country. You know, so I guess what I'm trying to ask you, Brother Malachi, what is the point of protest anymore?
Brother, I'll be quite honest with you. You know, the part of my you know, short sabbatical I've been taking was to reflect on a lot of this, and how to, you know, how to dialogue with not only my comrades who, you know, who tend to pretty much stand, you know, with me and agree a lot with a lot of what you just said, but seem to be stuck in a mode of march, protest, organize, do work, and, you know, and at the beginning of the year, do it all over again. But things don't seem to be changing. And then obviously you've got the liberal activist set who, you know, are pretty much stuck on that same cycle in differing ways. You know, they're more from the careerist standpoint, you know, of, you know, you do your campus activist thing, and then you move into the not-for-profit realm, and you know, and you continue to do your work and pretend as if you are actually moving and transforming society. I ran into here in Seattle some young people who I guess they've started an anti-fascist coalition or organization in the Capitol Hill area of Seattle. Mm-hmm. And they were about Antifa. Okay. Well, they're here. You know, you see them marching and putting up their flyers and posters and so forth. And you know, and in essence, when I talked to them, you know, I said, listen, you know, continue to do your work. I said, but you know what? It's time for all of us to basically, you know, stop normalizing a lot of this. You know, I think a lot of us, and I've said this to my comrades as well, we normalize struggle, we normalize oppression, we normalize in the work that we're doing, even though a lot of us are in pain and we're sitting around and we're watching our people be, you know, this slow motion extermination of African people and of indigenous people. And we've normalized it, you know, and at what point do you, as you said, at what point is it futile, you know? So from my standpoint, at this point, brother, I've become very short with not only, you know, some of the longtime, you know, folks and, you know, who've been struggling around issues. You know, old timers, you know, old time revolutionary and organizations who've been around for a minute. But I'm also, you know, I'm not really taking shit from ordinary folks and an activist who want to continue to careerize this, you know, struggle and organization. Because as you've said and touched on, I think a lot of it is becoming passé. You know, I had a conversation with someone recently, who I watched as pretty much his own friends were pretty much making fun of his love of struggle and of standing with people, you know, and watched his friends pretty much ridicule him about his politics. And he was very polite about it. And I said to him, brother, well, why are you being so polite? You know, because I had a experience with someone I just grew up with. I grew up with who pretty much made fun of my experiences within struggle and struggle in general. And I'll be quite honest with you. I cut him the fuck off, you know, because that's where I'm standing now. You know, if anyone who wants to make light of where we are at this stage, you know, and it, obviously we were here before Trump came in, you know, anyone who wants to make light of that and who wants to subconsciously continue with business as usual, I'm putting the smackdown on, you know, I'm not going to continue to accept lukewarm behavior from people, you know. Not from my comrades and not from people in general. And I think that's the stage is which we are. And not to say that it's time that we become extremists. That's not the point that I'm making. The point that I'm making is we have to stop normalizing suffering. We got to stop normalizing madness. You know, whether the madness is somebody like Obama or Hillary, or whether it's someone like who's obviously a piece of scum like Trump.
Yeah, it's really a conundrum in the social sense, because how do you sit there with folks who condone this or who passively are saying, well, since it's not happening to me, I don't see why you need to be negative about it. And whether you raise your voice or not. You know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you, because we have touched on it before in our various conversations, is, white activists use, and I'm not trying to be offensive in saying white activists, but, you know, I never heard this, even though I've seen it, but we didn't have a term for it, at least that I could remember, or a way to explain it in the black community, from my understanding where I was, gaslighting. Because, you know, we we experienced it, but we never had a way to articulate it. And that's one thing that we actually can say we positively learned from white activists. How when you ask a white lady what time it is at the bus stop, and she grabs her purse and moves it to the other side and steps away three steps from you and looks at you as if, you know, you're about to do the shower scene from Psycho on.
Right, right.
And then there's several other white folks who already don't think very positively of people of color, who see her reaction. All you did was ask for the time. They see her reaction. You know, here come the authorities, right? Now, because of cell phones, cameras, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, Facebook, black people can be, you would think people would figure this out by now, can be gaslighted, I don't know exactly what the term would be. And we've been experiencing this for so goddamn long. So my question to you is, brother, when it comes to not taking, slack from comrades as well as adversaries when we're out here dealing on the grind, how do we deal with the concept of gaslighting? Because I realize, just as you do, on when we bring up certain subjects, I don't give a fuck what the political conversation is, and they'll ask you, well, hey, what do you really think about such and such? And when you'll say, well, look, the majority of white women who voted for Trump, since it was a majority of white women who did vote for Trump, this is not me. This is what the stats are saying, that they overwhelmed the votes for males, that he actually got the white female vote in America. What vote he got?
That's right. My God, exactly what does that say, right? What does it say? As I was saying to you when we were off the air, I have a good friend here in Seattle, I don't know if she considers herself liberal, but, I would say her views are probably pretty liberal. She's a white woman, but she didn't vote for Trump, but she definitely lends her support to Trump. And before I left New York City, I was sitting in gentrified Brooklyn, and I watched as it was mostly white men, I will admit this, who pretty much 2 days after Trump was elected, they, were giving each other high fives, meeting up in Starbucks and congratulating each other. so to watch this, and obviously you and I were also talking about the black folks who supported Trump, Latino folks who supported Trump. It's as I was saying to you before, brother, I think this is an opportunity for, those of us who are radical leftists and even those who are on the liberal left to reflect on what exactly our principles are, and how does that, how does that apply to actually engaging poor people? And engaging working class people, obviously there are folks who lent their support to Trump who you're never going to be able to reach. You're never going to be able to dialogue with them. You're never going to find any commonality with them. But it makes me think about and this is very important. In 1969, the Black Panther Party created a coalition of poor people, and this included the Young Lords Party, which obviously largely comprised of Puerto Rican folks. The organization was called a Young Patriots, and their symbol was the Confederate flag, amazingly enough, and the Black Panther Party. Now, the conditions that the Black Panther Party put on this this white patriot organization was that they denounce racism, which they eventually did. They eventually denounced racism because they did see, they did learn the commonality of poor folks, you know, and so they didn't really feel any need to, after some time, to hold on to their anti-black and racist views. And I think I don't know if that explains, obviously that doesn't explain away why white women lended their support to this man, the man who is apt to you know, put a kung fu grip on a woman when he meets her. I don't know if that would change things, because that in and of itself, man, I haven't been able to wrap my mind around that either. What would motivate someone to put their daughters in harm's way? Because this is exactly what it's going to do. You have the most powerful man holding, you know, the most powerful seat in the world, saying it's, in essence, it's okay. It's okay to sexually assault women. And the fact that so many women lent their support to this man, I have yet to wrap my mind around that either.
Well, I mean, if you're an evangelical Christian, I suppose you can do a fallback and say, well, hey, Lot was going to throw his virgin daughters to the mob to protect the angels, right? So.
Oh, right. Exactly. Right.
You know, I mean, what happened? And then, you know, what did Lot do when his daughters got him drunk because they thought that they were the only people left in the world? So.
No, you make an excellent point. Not to cut you off, but you make an excellent point. So, are you thinking that maybe the standpoint, at least from the men who may have daughters who supported Trump, that the conditions are just so bad that in order to change them, it's even worth sacrificing your daughters?
Well, I mean, in some sense, because if you're a fundamentalist Christian, then that means that everything that happened in the Bible is literal. It's all true. And that is the only guidebook or the only guideline through those examples, because they're biblical examples that one should follow. So in that case, there would be no conflict. Don't the Mormons have that sort of viewpoint?
I'm not aware.
I mean, how do they justify having more than one wife? On biblical literalism.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So, you know, if you're going to excuse, you know, whatever the hell, you can excuse just about everything if you really understand the Bible well enough, and if you're willing to go through, what is it, the 22 versions? Or is it 24 now? And you can find exactly the sentence, the clause that you want to justify whatever it is that's in your desire.
Well, that I'm aware of. We can find justification in the Bible for lynching Africans, you know, and decimating an entire continent of savages, right?
Yeah, you know, and it's always a question on who the savages are. It depends on where you are, right? In Mauritania.
Right.
You know, how hard is it to explain to a brother in Dallas, Texas, that in Mauritania, the Arabization that's going on, if I show you photographs of the perpetrators and the victims, you'll think that they're the one and the same people. But when they see each other, they see ethnic differences. You know, it's very hard to explain. Because there's no education here in terms of understanding how this works. You know, I still speak to brothers who think that if they go to Mexico, they'd just be walking with open arms.
Oh, well, there may be one town in Mexico where there are Africans where they might be embraced, but in Mexico as a whole, I doubt it.
I doubt it, right? I mean, somewhere in Veracruz or Oaxaca, you know, you might be able to find some respite, or you know, in Colombia. Even in Uruguay, you know, there's pockets of Africans all up and down South America. And then, you know, when you show people, you know, videos on YouTube or whatever, and they're like, what, really? And it's like, yeah, there's black people in Iraq. There's black people in Iran. There's black people in Palestine. There's black people. They're like, well, how did they get there? And it's like, because of slavery. Really? Yeah, really. You know, they don't, you know, there's no, you know, I mean, Africans in China, there's no sense of that history. You know, quick before we take a break here, you know, how are we going to move forward in a situation that we have with Trump, say, when we have a people who have no sense of their own history at all?
Hmm. Well, you know, in what you were talking about, the imperialists have been extremely adept at propaganda. You know, to coin a phrase from, you know, my Twitter handle there. They've been great at that, and basically erasing over the last 50 years all of the work of the anti-colonial and revolutionary movements. They've been adept at creating a sanitized version of history, and sanitized in the sense that it pretty much obliterates the dark presence of dark peoples throughout the world. And the truth is, it's like, and no one knows. It is absolutely astounding. It is almost the presence of African and dark people throughout the world has almost become the thing of conspiracy theory and myth.
The magic, you know, Negro.
Absolutely. Negro. So they have been, they have been, it's been amazing what they've been able to do to almost erase reality. You know, whereas people that are walking, living and breathing and exist and struggling actually in throughout the world, going active struggles. You know, the struggle of the people in Papua and against the Indonesians, New mm-hmm. Guinea, Papua New Guinea. Mm-hmm. You know, people, no one knew they existed. You know, largely folks did not know these folks existed. You know, and that's and we can get into my trip to Hawaii too, and the Micronesian population there in Hawaii, who is also being discriminated against, not just by, you know, the system of the state there, but also, you know, other Hawaiians or other brown people, which is pretty sick as well. But touching on, and again, I can, you know, when we get into Hawaii, I can, you know, talk about, you know, a lot of what I did see in Hawaii was, you know, horrific levels of homelessness, of indigenous Hawaiian people, of Micronesians who, you know, who are, you know, pretty much kind of shoved to the outskirts, and they're the new, you know, I don't even want to say the you know, the word that we're probably both thinking, mm-hmm. but it seems that they've been pushed to the bottom of Hawaii. You know, you can even find videos of young Micronesians complaining about the forms of discrimination that they are experiencing from everyone in Hawaii. Hawaii has become the deep south of the Pacific. You know, the levels of racism that I experienced there, my experience, man, started before I even got off the plane. I had it was amazing, man. It was amazing.
Okay, you know, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Like I said, it's been a long time since we spoke to this brother, and as always, he comes with, you know, hardcore reality. We're going to talk about his experiences in Hawaii in terms of brown people versus brown people. And if we're going to deal with the conditions that we see coming with a Trump presidency, if we don't deal with who the people who are standing behind us and next to us, you know, if we're not looking at the crowd in which we're amidst, then a lot of this, you know, whether we have a plan or don't have a plan, is just going to lead to implosion. So this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, and I'm the Angry Indian. And we're speaking with Malachi Daniels, who was sitting somewhere in a cafe in Seattle, Pacific Northwest. Please stay tuned.
is Violent Fanon, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is an international call out to the world. We are asking everybody worldwide to do whatever you can do. And what needs to be done is you need to go to the streets. And you need to protest. You need to do whatever you can to help us, to protect us. Take action where you are. Take railroads. Take bridges. Do it. Take strong hearts. Anybody who's fighting resource extraction, have a strong heart. And do it! Stand up for your rights! They cannot stop us all! Worldwide, this is your call! Resistance! Warriors! They're harming your territory! Stop them!
The wind comes in four corners, four directions, four colors. And death rides on four horsemen, a black snake with some black tanks. How much money do these companies need to make?
Coming to you live.
I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/HideInCopFire.
Nicely played. Sachin is off the mark.
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ। घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
Thanks to our moccasin telegraph line. I am the real Sasheen Littlefeather. Thanks to our moccasin telegraph line, I recently became aware that my identity is being fraudulently used on Facebook. I want you to know, this is my understanding, that even though I have no Facebook page, someone has been claiming that I endorse their fundraising. This is absolutely untrue. I have not endorsed this fundraising via the internet or other means. My photos and largely falsified biographical information have appeared without my knowledge or permission. You, the people, have been duped. People have been fraudulently using my name and my image, soliciting for monies for the Lakota Indian people. The monies have been going to individuals, not Indian people at all. On Facebook, they have been using the American Indian page, the American Indian website, the American Indian 8 on Twitter, the American Indians and Friends.com, the Grandmother's Circle, Operation Warm Winter, Tetuan Grandmother's Society, all of these via a PayPal account to line their own pocketbooks at your expense. And at my expense, fraudulently using my name and my image, the real Sasheen Littlefeather. I do not have, and I have never had, a Facebook account. I've recently become aware that these people are running this fraudulent Facebook pages, and I want to make you aware of this as well. As an elder and a lifelong activist for Indian rights, I am distressed and upset by this deceptive practice and pray that the Creator will continue to aid us in seeking justice for our people. I remain Sasheen Littlefeather. My only official website is Sasheen Cruz Littlefeather. Thank you.
Missy Elliott for the Black AIDS Institute.
HIV happens to us more than it does anybody else, which is why we should all get tested, because if we don't step up, then nobody will.
Get informed, get tested, get treated, and get involved. For more information, call the Black AIDS Institute at 213-353-3610. That's 213-353-3610. Or online at www.blackaids.org.
I'm Carol Warden. The Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center asked for your help in spreading awareness of the National Public Awareness Campaign for the availability of Plan B within Indian Health Service. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that is routinely denied to Native women at IHS facilities. Although Plan B has been available without a prescription for adult women since 2006 and as of 2009 available to women aged 17 and up, it is still not provided over-the-counter at 90% of IHS pharmacies. Our goal is to ensure that Plan B is available as an over-the-counter contraceptive for all Native women and to incorporate access of Plan B into standardized sexual assault policies within IHS. We also seek to inform Native women of their right to Plan B so that they are able to make informed decisions regarding their reproductive health. Please help us get the word out. Native women are entitled to the same level of health care as all other women. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
I Don't Know More calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution,
to honor indigenous sovereignty,
and protect the land and water
for generations to come.
Mexicans, South Americans, all indigenous people, get inspired,
take action,
and become a part of the solution.
It's my future,
your future,
our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Become idle no more.
Just wear me in. My name is Dwight Robinson. The real killer in the crime, Calvin Barbie's innocent. This is my African dream, just where we get. My name is Dwight Robinson. I wanna confess to the murder, Calvin Barbie's innocent. My name is Dwight Robinson, swear me in. I'm writing this affidavit to help free your innocent men. Good Lord, and the exoneration of Calvin Barbie. My fault, letting them sit and rot the crimes I committed. Federal homicide, I caught the bodies and testified. In 95, that it was Calvin that was alive. Well, September 10th, 1992, I killed the head was brother Duke. Who was a dispute? They told me, don't be seen without their loot. I took that to mean when they see me, they gon' shoot. So, what was out of you? Came out the alley with the 9 semi-automatic. Hit the beam up, run down the ass like a bath. Heard a block up, spray it, wash it in a blood bath. Coroner on the corner, he can do the aftermath. Gotta kill 4, kill 2, now it's 2 more. Calvin and Jay, I'ma fill them both for the hoes. Don't know how did they survive, I'm surprised, only God knows. All I know is Calvin gotta go, I'ma take the toll. Take another road, another try. Get some false witnesses in court to tell a lie. Now I'm Calvin with the trigger guy at the restaurant. And the rest is all police want. Come on. They don't give a damn who up in the cop car. Long as a nigga gets caught, no problem. Calvin, always be on the block. Yeah. It'll be easy to time to the crime. He'll be at the spot where the Harris brothers hustled all the time. Yeah. Not a born, I think I'm about to drop a dime. Yeah. 911, homicides on the line. Whoop. Do him like Big, say he going real hard. Have him pushing weight, no spot, prison yard. I know you think it's real sucker shit. Yeah. But don't blame me, used to blame the government for letting it proceed.
sense. They just want a convict. All black men don't give a damn if you're guilty or innocent. Maybe that's why I'm writing this. Cause I done did too many hits for the nemesis. Free Calvin Ball rape cause he innocent. Forgive Dwight Robinson the penitent. Killer, come on. Free Calvin Ball rape. Locked up innocent for murder. Just wear me in. My name is Dwight Robinson. I'm the real killer in the crime. Come on, Calvin Ball, he's innocent. Just wear me in. My name is Dwight Robinson. Come on, I wanna confess to the murder. Calvin Ball, he's innocent. Come on, this is my affidavit. Just wear me in. My name is Dwight Robinson. Come on, I'm the real killer in the crime. Calvin Ball, he's innocent. This is my affidavit. Just wear me in. My name is Dwight Robinson, come on. I wanna confess to the murder. Calvin Ball, he's innocent. This is my affidavit. Yeah. One child at a time. Free Calvin Ball record. Innocent. Doing 25 to life. For murders you didn't commit.
Hey, this is Jonathan Colton, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license. CC, baby. Check it out.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA. Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA.
Every day, one more Aboriginal person will test positive for HIV. Some will be rejected by their family, friends, and community. They will live in isolation, their voices no longer heard. HIV/AIDS stigma and discrimination denies our people the right to protect their future. You can make a difference. Be their voice.
ಬರುತ್ತಿದೆ ಎಲ್ಲಡೆ ಭೀಕರವಾಗಿ ಏಡ್ಸು ಏಡ್ಸು ಏಡ್ಸೋ ನಮ್ಮ ವೈರಿಗೂ ಬಾರದಿರಲಿ ಅದು ಓಡ್ಸು ಓಡ್ಸು ಓಡ್ಸೋ
ಹೆಚ್ಚಿನ ಲೈಂಗಿಕ ಸಂಪರ್ಕದ ಸೋಂಕುಗಳು ವಾಸಿಯಾಗುತ್ತವೆ ಆದರೆ ಏಡ್ಸ್ಗೆ ಚಿಕಿತ್ಸೆ ಇಲ್ಲ
ಏಡ್ಸ್ಗೆ ತುತ್ತಾಗಿರುವ ವ್ಯಕ್ತಿಗಳಿಗೆ ನಿಮ್ಮಿಂದ ಬೇಕಾಗಿರುವುದು ಭೇದ ಭಾವ ಉಪೇಕ್ಷೆಯಲ್ಲ ಅವರಿಗೆ ಅಗತ್ಯವಿರುವುದು ನಿಮ್ಮ ಪ್ರೀತಿ ಅನುಕಂಪ ಮತ್ತು ಬೆಂಬಲ
ಕಾಂಡಮ್ ಅಥವಾ ನಿರೋಧ ಬಳಕೆ ಲೈಂಗಿಕ ಸಂಗಾತಿಗಳ ಸಂಖ್ಯೆ ಹೆಚ್ಚಷ್ಟು ಎಚ್ಐವಿ ಸೋಂಕು ತಗುಲುವ ಅಪಾಯವೂ ಹೆಚ್ಚುತ್ತದೆ ಒಂದು ಪಕ್ಷ ನಿಮಗೆ ಎಚ್ಐವಿ ಸೋಂಕು ಇದೆ ಎಂದು ಗೊತ್ತಾದರೆ ನಿಮ್ಮ ಆರೋಗ್ಯವನ್ನು ಕಾಪಾಡಿಕೊಂಡು ಹೋಗಲು ನಿಮಗೆ ಮತ್ತು ನಿಮ್ಮ ಕುಟುಂಬದವರಿಗೆ ಸ್ವಯಂ ಪ್ರೇರಿತ ಸಮಾಲೋಚನೆ ಮತ್ತು ಪರೀಕ್ಷಾ ಕೇಂದ್ರದವರು ಸಹಾಯ ಮಾಡುವರು
ಚಿಕಿತ್ಸೆಗೊಳಗಾಗದ ಲೈಂಗಿಕ ರೋಗಗಳಾದ ಯೋನಿಯ ಸ್ರಾವ ಮತ್ತು ಗಾಯ ಹುಣ್ಣು ಕಿಬ್ಬೊಟ್ಟೆಯಲ್ಲಿ ನೋವು ಮತ್ತು ಸಂಭೋಗದ ಸಮಯದಲ್ಲಿ ನೋವುವಿರುವ ಸ್ತ್ರೀಯರಿಗೆ ಎಚ್ಐವಿ ಸೋಂಕು ತಗುಲುವ ಅಪಾಯ ಹೆಚ್ಚು
ಏಡ್ಸ್ ಬಾರದಂತೆ ತಡೆಗಟ್ಟಲು ನೀವು ನಿಮ್ಮ ಸಂಗಾತಿ ಇಬ್ಬರಲ್ಲೂ ಪರಸ್ಪರ ವಿಶ್ವಾಸ ಪ್ರೀತಿ ನಿಷ್ಠೆ ಇರಲಿ ನಿಮ್ಮದು ಏಕಪತಿ ಮತ್ತು ಏಕಪತ್ನಿತ್ವ ಸಂಬಂಧವಾಗಿರಲಿ
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
And the Democrats are throwing the election away. For what? An inadequate black male who would not have been running had it not been a white woman that was running for president. I'm no second-class citizen. And God damn the Democrats.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
This is APNS Public Radio.
So this is Jen Gorlick. I'm an activist in D.C. I support a free and unoccupied Palestine, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Okay, welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. This is a broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service. We're still in the virtual studio with Malachi Daniels. He's broadcasting from a cafe somewhere within the wilds of Coffeeland, Seattle. We're both in the Pacific Northwest. I'm holding it down here in Portlandia. We're touching base. We haven't spoken since the Trump thing, the whole alt-right thing, this whole, you know, Obama never did nothing to America thing. You know, we're looking at that right now. And since we're talking about Obama, and we've already acknowledged that he didn't do a whole lot for black people, but he certainly did a hell of a lot for America as a whole, where he was born and raised, Hawaii, despite what the birthers have to say. Brother Malachi was there for a while. And as usual, you know, he took stock of what he was experiencing, and he just totally bewildered, he tells me, by what the fuck he saw. So, Brother Daniels, you know, what the hell happened down there in Hawaii?
Oh, well, well, you know, one of the things I was hoping to do in traveling to Hawaii was to touch base with, you know, with the independence movement. That was my hopes, and touch base with also with a couple of other comrades who I'd heard were doing work down there, and also take some time to you know, to recuperate from some, you know, some long hard time in New York City. But what I found was very interesting. Before I even got off the plane, you know, the levels of racism that I encountered. I was on Hawaiian Airlines, and the flight attendant who happened to be serving my aisle, and I can't say exactly what this sister's racial mix was, but one of the things that happened is when I initially saw her, man, I was very happy to see her, because she was a sister who was several shades darker than myself. She looked like she was, you know, she was part Hawaiian, but, you know, was possible, likely also had, you know, several other Asian mixtures as well. And not to, you know, it was in no way to fetishize at all. It was just like, oh, great. This is, you know, what I had heard about Hawaii. I'm going to go to Hawaii, and I'm going to see a lot of what looks like me. All right, that may make this trip a little bit more easy to take. But this woman made it very clear almost immediately that she was displeased with my presence. She made a point of being extremely abrupt with me, you know, in essence, really treating me as if I had never been on a plane before. And you know, sees the other. Put your tray down, you know. And but it, and by comparison, I had a young white guy sitting next to me, and she was extremely pleasant to him.
that's it right there.
Right. So when I eventually did complain to the other flight staff, he had a look of shock on his face. Because he had a look on his face that said, wow, she's been absolutely an angel to me, you know. And I think that has to do with what you were talking about earlier in terms of white folks' awareness, you know, and the whole idea of, you know, approaching white people and white people questioning, you know, your experience, you know, with white supremacy, you know, in various iterations, you know, of colonial mentalities and such. But one of the things that was very interesting about this this woman is later on she was absolutely perplexed by the fact that I complained after, and this is, she showed up towards the end of my flight just in time to actually snatch my tray out of my hand, as if to, as an exclamation for her behavior throughout the entire flight. But she was perplexed by my complaint of her, you know, as if, you know, I should you know, accept this behavior, that, you know, a black man or any kind of brown person should accept this behavior from her. She was perplexed by that. But that was the beginning of Hawaii. And I think not too long after landing in Hawaii, I went looking for a restaurant to eat at. And I made my way to a Korean restaurant that was open until midnight. I had researched this restaurant. And when I got there, the Korean owner, she was outside. And as I made my way to the door, she said to me, we're closed. Now, mind you, it was about maybe 10:40 at this point. And I said, well, your sign says you're open to midnight. And it also says on the internet that you're open until midnight. She says, well, and she looked at the ground searching for an explanation. She says, well, we have new owners now. and basically told me, yeah, in essence, she wasn't going to serve me anything. You know, and so this was the beginning of my experience in Hawaii. And mind you, I did meet some cool people after that who directed me to a place to eat late at night. But that was the beginning.
So, you know, that's, you know, I'm sorry to hear that, but, you know, I'm not surprised. You know, I've told people when you travel, you make an assumption when you first, you know, your first few experiences, that when you see other brown people, especially if you're mixed race, that when you see other brown people, there'll be some kind of, you know, nod, some kind of like, hey, you know, I see you, you see me. And it's really disappointing.
Right.
When, you know, it's not like that.
It's extremely disappointing. And, you know, part of my needing to back up and take a reflection on my politics and where we are was a lot of the experiences that I was going through in New York, where there is this new, it's not new, but it's become more extreme, this divide between black men and black women. And it's so pronounced in New York City now because we have such an influx of white Midwesterners who have pretty much, in bringing their wealth to New York City and recolonizing our neighborhoods, has pretty much thrown a light on the contradictions amongst black people in New York City. Whereas New Yorkers have always had this kind of braggadocious thing about being black and being pro-African. What it did was it exposed that a lot of that was just talk without any substance. You know, it was a whole lot of pro-blackness without any natural affinity for Africanness, you know, and that they exposed that we didn't really like each other, you know. So now when you go to New York City, you see a bunch of interracial relationships that are born out of convenience. They're born out of economic opportunism, and they're born out of racial fascination and sexual opportunism. And black men and black women don't really talk to each other in public. So then going to Hawaii and obviously seeing this kind of thing, and also, mind you, I did run into black people in Hawaii as well, and most of whom did not want to speak to me either. You know, it also blew my mind to go to Hawaii and see black men and black women who had left the mainland only to go to Hawaii to once again pick up the same behavior and partner with someone white and refuse to speak with other black people. You know, which threw me for a loop. I would think that in a place like Hawaii, where there is a great deal of quote unquote racial diversity, that the colonial indoctrination of African people in North America is so intense that they would go to a place like Hawaii and not even seek out maybe someone from Thailand or someone who, you know, or someone Japanese or even Hawaiian. And not to say that I didn't see that, but it was very clear to me that most of the black people who were living in Hawaii were doing the same behavior that I had seen in several cities throughout the U.S. And did not want to speak with me, did not want to speak with other black people, and honestly didn't seem to be dealing with Native Hawaiians that much either. You know, so it, and also, the, you know, to see the sense of ownership that white men in Hawaii have of Asian women. As you probably know, as you probably know, Hawaii is a very highly militarized, especially Oahu is highly militarized. So obviously you have a great deal of military people there, and a lot of white men who serve in the military there, a lot of them stay there as well. And so there's a culture that you probably see throughout the places where the imperialist military of the United States has stationed itself. You know, we see in the old Vietnam War movies of how white men treated Asian women, you know, as property in Vietnam and you know, in other places where we're in Korea, where American military men are stationed. Where Hawaii, that's never really changed. Hawaii became a permanent, has become like a permanent, you know, version of that. So it's very much that kind of imperialist and colonial objectification of particularly Asian women is pretty much institutionalized in Hawaii. Where Asian women seem to be raised to understand that they are the property of these military white men. And I'll tell you an incident that really illustrates this perfectly. One night I was out going to a restaurant, and I was sitting outside the restaurant waiting to be seated. And it was right around Christmas time. And so everybody was kind of, you know, drunk and, you know, walking around in Santa Claus hats and whatnot. So I saw a couple come out of a restaurant, a white man and an Asian woman. He was clearly fall down drunk, and he kept trying to put his hands on this woman's breast, putting his hand on her buttocks, and she's fighting him off. But at the same time, this is her boyfriend, you know. So in essence, she's trying to keep him from embarrassing her in public, but and she's also trying to stand him up at the same time because he's drunk. And so everyone's watching this. And so at one point, he stops and he looks at two white women who are working in a store, are standing outside, and he says to them, "Hey, watch this." And then he proceeds to lift up his girlfriend's, this Asian woman, to lift up her dress above her head and cup her ass in front of everybody. So, you know, he wanted to show everybody that nobody, no matter what I do to this woman, no matter how much I degrade and humiliate this woman, she understands she's my property. And there was one guy who actually stepped in to try to separate them. The Asian woman turned to this man and said, "Mind your business."
Mm-hmm.
I saw an incident like this more than once in Hawaii.
So yeah, I mean, I've seen, you know, similar things, you know, at bus stops in Seattle, where you are now, where, you know, you look at this white cat, and again, I'm not trying to be rude, but not a 10.
Right.
And he's shouting down, you know, his, I assume she was Filipino. I think I know my own people when I see them.
Right.
Couldn't really intervene. He wasn't hitting her, you know, but he was fucking embarrassing the fuck out of her. I don't know what happened. Wasn't my business, but it was just really bad. And I mean, it's, you know, it's like you said, it's a colonialist, you know, paradigm that the women of any particular you know, location, any locale that they go to, that they have a right to these women. that, you know, these women cannot say no to them, you know, that these women are somehow, as you put it, you know, property of these men. And then to argue against that is somehow to be against family, to be against God. And then they start to stretch it that you're against the social order, you know, somewhat like The Handmaid's Tale.
Mm.
You know, which a lot of people, you know what I'm saying? You know, which a lot of people are wondering, you know, where we're going with this sort of thing. And, you know, and as a black man, you know, when you observe these sorts of things, and then you saw the ethnic rivalries that were going there, and then you see the, you know, the handful of white people who have ultimate control, and then you see the shift in control, say, between, as you were telling me, you know, before we went on the air, between, you know, the Japanese and the Chinese, you know, what was going through your mind? As you said, you were experiencing racism before you even got off the plane. You know, what was really going through your head as you got back stateside?
you know, obviously, when you're in the midst of it, it's painful. You know, because initially, I didn't have my revolutionary cap on. You know, I wanted to take a moment to actually enjoy the people, enjoy Hawaii, and maybe, you know, as they say, just be a human being. I just want to be a human being for a second. I said, well, okay, well, let me try the quote unquote human being hat for a second. And I did that and found out that I'm not allowed to be a human being as an African man. My revolutionary or activist hat has to be on all the time, and you really can't necessarily put your guard down. And I wouldn't say it's just in America either. My reflection upon leaving was, you know, because at some point during the trip, I had to really get hardcore about what I was seeing, and I had to pretty much pull out my camera and start recording what I was seeing and making commentary on it. And rather than being reactionary and reacting to the things that were coming at me, I had to be more proactive and start to engage people and question them about things. And one of the interesting things that happened, because I was actually one day in a coin laundry, and I happened to be in a coin laundry with a black man, a Hawaiian man, and a Japanese woman. And I looked at them all, and I said to them, you folks, you appear to be keeping secrets down here. You're keeping Hawaii's secrets. I said, you've got a very serious class and race issue problem down here. And I said, you folks are keeping secrets. And so the Japanese woman and the Hawaiian man pretty much kind of looked at the ground and kind of sort of agreed. But it was the black man, the older black man, who spoke up. And this was very interesting. He was an older black man from Rochester, New York, and a Trump supporter. and he was very offended by what I was saying. He immediately said, well, Hawaiians have been very good to me. And I said, I'm not necessarily speaking of I thought that might make you laugh, brother.
Okay, sorry.
Right. Right. It reminds you of folks in the South that used to say white folks have been very good to me, right?
Well, no offense out for the Mason-Dixon line. East right. and West of the Rockies. I mean, it's the same thing.
Right.
White folks have been good to me, underline, capital, and me.
Right.
What they do to you is exactly. something else. You know.
And that was the crux of the conversation. He and I, I got very specific with him. I said, that's great that you have, you know, a great experience with Hawaiian folks. He was talking about his employer and how his employer had taken very good care of him. And I had a big smile on my face, of course, as he said these things. And I said, well, that's great for you. And I said, what about the other economic forces that are at play here that are creating these conditions? And he kind of stared at me. And I said, there's a problem here. And I ran down some of my experiences and some of the things that I witnessed. And, you know, he basically shrugged his shoulders and basically really looked at me as if I was the enemy, as a younger black man who was pointing out economic, racial, class disparity in this place that he, you know, I guess had he feels that he had found a level of paradise. You know, but and that was a pretty common with the black folks that I encountered in Hawaii. They felt that they should just be grateful to be allowed to be in Hawaii. As a matter of fact, I even had right. And as a matter of fact, I even had one black woman question me as to whether I had the right to be in Hawaii without at least, you know, some bank, you know, to be able to set myself up in grand fashion. You know, she in essence, she literally said to me, she said, well, what are you doing here? You know, which floored.
She
which
named
floored.
It?
Oh, she, this sister, she had no native Hawaiian heritage. This sister was from Dallas.
So what's she talking to you about then?
Invited. Right. Exactly. Exactly. But she felt that because she was plugged in such a way that it afforded her a lifestyle in Hawaii that, you know, she could pretty much blend in to a degree, that had somehow legitimized her. And so, you know, again, it wasn't just a race issue, obviously, largely in a place like Hawaii where you have You know, I don't know how many, what the percentage of millionaires that you have in Hawaii, but it's very high. Mm-hmm. You know, she felt like, you know, that made her more legitimate than me. And that I probably needed to take my black ass back to Harlem where I came from.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, man, look, brother, I can relate. I mean, I've told you, we've talked about this before, you know, when you're in that club and you're the only motherfucking ink spot, man, and you got maybe like 6% of those women who are looking at you because you are the only black guy in there, not because you're the best looking, not because you got the best clothes, but it's the novelty. So you've been doing this for several years, and then here comes this young guy. He's got a better body than you. He's actually good looking. He's probably better endowed than you too, right? So, do you want to have to share this bullshit with him? No. Right? I'm going to be the only nigga in this motherfucking spot. Find your own goddamn locale. You know, go someplace else.
Right, I call that the pink poodle syndrome.
The pink poodle syndrome, yeah. Right. You know, I mean, go, you know, find your own white folks. You know, where you can be the, you know, the token Negro at their table, because don't come in and fuck up my spot. That's what it comes down to.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, brother. It is probably one of the most common, you know, kind of, you know, slave mentality psychoses that there is. It's, you know, and I did get quite a bit of that from Africans in Hawaii when I spoke to them. And it was because there are, you know, most of the homeless in Hawaii are Native Hawaiian or some variation of Native Hawaiian. The next would probably be Micronesian folks in the various, you know, white escapees is what I call them, you know, the white people who've escaped the mainland and decided they're gonna kick up and be homeless in Hawaii, and then and then there are the black folks who are homeless as well, and so a lot of the black people in Hawaii who are doing well They are hyper aware of the black people who are not doing well. And so their ideas don't speak to me because you are going to remind people that I'm black.
I'm black. Uh-huh.
And you're going to remind people that I'm black, and I don't want to be associated. I don't need the stigma of you, in essence, you poor Negroes. You poor down and out Negroes. Because it is in a place like Hawaii, especially in Honolulu, in various areas like Waikiki, it is extremely well-oiled mechanism in Honolulu, where it is a machine. It's interesting because it's Hawaii and there is the natural beauty, but it's very noisy. Honolulu is very noisy, and one of the reasons that it's very noisy is, one, obviously you've got all of this mass consumer monstrosities, and I'll get to that aspect of it too, but it's a well-oiled machine that wants to not only keep the tourists moving and consuming, but it also wants to keep the homeless and the poor moving. So one of the things that I saw and I marveled at in Waikiki in particular is that they have a lot of little jobs that people can get. There was one man, and his job was to clean the bottoms of the payphones. That's all he did, is he wiped the bottom of the payphone stands. So there are various jobs like that, and all of it is geared towards making Honolulu, or particularly Waikiki, look like a vision of, you know, of consumer paradise for tourists. And it also keeps the homeless and the poor, keeps them on edge, and it keeps them, you know, constantly knowing that there isn't any respite. You know, so you're constantly moving. You're constantly moving. There is no place really to rest, and not even on the beaches really for homeless people. And I honestly saw very few poor families, poor Hawaiian families. What I found out later was that many, and I did get to stay in the hood for a period. The quickly gentrifying hood. Which in many ways reminded me of places in New York City. And many of it looked like Brooklyn to me, looked like Brooklyn and Queens. So the areas like that are being gentrified by the Chinese, you know, and as I was telling you before, Hawaii is going from this transition where it seems to be changing hands. From economically from the Japanese to the Chinese. But it even seems, honestly, as if it's more serious than that. The population that you will largely see in particularly Oahu now is largely Chinese and Korean. The Chinese have built a giant mall in the center of Honolulu. I believe it's called the Ala Mona Mall, and it's a monstrosity. And it took me a little while to find out, but it was eventually revealed to me that mall is the largest mall in the world. And this is the mall that you will see scores of homeless Hawaiian people sleeping in front of at night. It's a sight. It's a sight.
That I mean, that, you know, Hawaii as a microcosm of what's going on with the rest of the country. You know, I wanted to ask you about it. You know, being that you told me you were there, because I've spoken to white people, to Asian folks, to, you know, Native Hawaiians over the years who have just talked about it as such a monstrosity of ethnic simmering animosity. I mean, you know, nothing positive to be said about Hawaii. And then, you know, when you used to hear positive things about Hawaii, it's because somebody got off the plane, got on the shuttle to their hotel, had fun at the hotel and whatever the other touristy things they did, went straight from that environment back to the airline. and that was the extent of their trip. So, right. You know, they didn't have to see any of the negative sides to Hawaii. I mean, just in, what do you call it, the Mayan Riviera down here in Mexico, they had a massive shootout today. 9 people were killed. The drug bit, you know, the whole gangster thing, this idea of taking the war on drugs, as the new Trump guy is talking about, 180 miles past the Rio Grande. I mean, you travel. What do you see happening with this sort of an attitude now with this new administration in terms of how they're going to extend their jurisdiction to prosecute basically not the real people who are behind human trafficking and what have you, behind the drug trade, but used just to squash journalists, activists, you know, people like Berta Cáceres. I mean, there was just another journalist killed in Honduras just yesterday. You have journalists who are missing in Nigeria. You know, how are we supposed to move forward when you have the number one, well, actually the only superpower, this is the number one power in the planet, led by someone like Trump, who is, you know, what he is, represents what he represents, and people who are actually trying to get this information out and be able to have these conversations such as the one we're having now.
Right, and I'll definitely you know, touch on that a bit. Just before I, you know, wrap up on the Hawaii thing, man, I did want to say that, and I did a little bit of investigation into, you know, where the Hawaiian independence movement is happening, what's going on with brothers and sisters down there involved in that movement, and was told by, more than one Hawaiian that they felt like the movement was in a bit of chaos, and that the movement had been split down the middle, and there was a great deal of infighting, some movement forward, but the infighting has largely stalled progress. To touch on what you were speaking about as well, and there, I did sense there was a lot of animosity that I sensed with Native Hawaiian folks. I even had a couple of brothers direct some of that at me. Obviously, I didn't take any of that personal because I understand where people's issues come from. You know, as I understand what, you know, the issues of African fratricide in Chicago and other places and around the world, where that comes from. I understand when a Hawaiian brother comes at me and attempts to rile me. I know where his stuff is coming from, so I didn't react to it. But it made this story that I told earlier about the woman on the plane, that could possibly be some of her, where her stuff comes from as well. You know, I had a couple of Hawaiian people say to me that, hey, if I changed my name, I could probably pass for Hawaiian. Just based upon the fact that my skin is a little bit darker than a lot of people. And so they were saying, well, you know, maybe the flight attendant, maybe I look like an old boyfriend. You know, they kind of laughed it off. But she makes a point, you know, that I guess there are different names for different racial mixtures in Hawaii, and I didn't get too deep into that. I felt it important not to get into those things because I didn't really want to adopt a lot of the mentalities of you know, the folks in Hawaii who I know were highly indoctrinated with these racial and colorism divisions. But I saw that a lot of that behavior was the negative behaviors between colored people. You know, I had people explain to me, they were just like, listen, this, our racism here in Hawaii is a very comfortable thing. It's not like the racism that you guys have on the mainland. It's almost like a lovable racism. You know, all those wacky Koreans, they don't really like anybody, so don't take it personal. That kind of thing.
I hear what you're saying, but you and I both know that that's bullshit.
Oh, absolutely. Without question. You know, especially when there is economic power and economic might behind the sentiment. You know, the Chinese folks and Koreans in Hawaii are able through their numbers and economic power create new policy and create culture. And they largely have. It was funny enough, a white woman who had moved to Hawaii in the 80s, she was actually German and a supporter of Trump, explained to me and her, you know, she said that she felt that the Chinese and Koreans had ruined Hawaii because the Chinese and Koreans don't believe in any kind of racial diversity. You know, and so I found this funny that this German woman was now looking at, you know, Chinese people as some sort of as the invasive, quote unquote, invasive species. You know, in a sense, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. It's a big trip.
It's a trip. It's a trip, you know. Like I said, Ms. Angry Indian is, you know, Christian Palestinian, and, you know, when a lot of, you know, African brothers and sisters see her, and when I say African, in a sense, I mean African American, you know, they see her and they say, okay, well, she must be mixed. So, when they see the two of us, they're like, okay, you don't see, normally see this, but two red bones, you know, together, right?
I see.
You know what I'm saying? But, you know, amongst, you know, the Arab world, you know, people would think, who don't know anything, that all Arabs just accept other Arabs. And it's like, no. You know, Palestinians are on the bottom, right? You know, then you got the Egyptians. Right. Then you got the Lebanese who feel that, you know, the French were in their country. So they're, you know, they're superior, right? Filipinos feel that because Spain was there, the United States was there, that they're superior to the rest of Southeast Asia. But then you have the Vietnamese who will say, well, the French were here, right? Then you got the Indonesians, well, the Dutch were here. So we're better than the next one. Or we have this going for us that you guys don't have. And in the West Indies, it's the same thing. Haitians are on the bottom. Despite the fact that they fought off French colonialism, French slavery, and liberated themselves, they're on the bottom in the African pecking order. Jamaicans, especially if they're mixed, they look down on everybody. Right? This is what you hear amongst West Indians. You know, people from Barbados and so on look down at those from Trinidad. People from Trinidad talk about, you know, people from Panama are low class. You know, those from Guyana who have of Indian descent, South Asian descent, you know, they talk about, you know, how Guyanese blacks are just, you know, backwards and what have you. You know, again, how are we going to move forward with this type of, you know, discrepancy and solidarity? You know, where the politics extend to tribalism.
You're absolutely right. It is amazing. And I think for me, and to wrap up, you know, Hawaii, not that we want to wrap it up. That was the most disheartening aspect to encounter young people. And when I say young people, I'm not just talking about people who are college age or, you know, in their late 20s or early 30s. I mean, very young people who have very comfortably slipped into these mentalities and adopted them as their own. And obviously, you see this all over the United States. I appear to be a pessimist to some of my comrades and others when I say that largely the American youth that I encounter are pretty shitty human beings. Obviously, I know some great young people. I know some revolutionary young people of all races. But by and large, most of the young people that I encounter have largely adopted the dominant capitalist colonizer, the worst of that attitude, the worst of that psychology, and it's scary. It's extremely scary and disheartening. So I concur with you, bro.
Yeah, I mean, it's you don't know where, you know, where do you go? It's like, you know, what the hell do you do? You would think that, okay, we got some people of color that would do this, that, and the other. And, you know, you can excuse the Steve Harvey clowns. You can excuse the Azalea Banks, you know, people. Mike Tyson, we all know that his mind is not his own. You know, we can, you know, ignore them. And who was it? Don King was out there waving flags and what have you. You know, and we're supposed to take this seriously. And of course, he says that this isn't a photo op. And then in the meantime, he totally disrespects John Lewis, of all people. Of all people. He gets away with this. He's still on Twitter. I mean, have you been paying attention to him on Twitter?
I've caught bits and pieces, and to be quite honest with you, brother, because as you were saying in the beginning, there's so many people that are, you know, on the, you know, the knee jerk, you know, well, Trump did this thing and Trump did this thing, that I've kind of tried to maintain a real objective distance, because he's so fucked up, that it's hard not to be incensed by what he does and what he says and the cabinet that he's putting together, that I'm doing my best to, you know, take a very scientific approach to everyone's reaction, so that I can really, you know, see pretty clearly what actually is taking place.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. I'm looking at Raw Story right now while I'm talking to you, which I don't particularly trust that much, because they have some weird links to Newsmax. I can get into that another time, but I'm looking at, you know, this is who's coming into office now. It says here, Trump offers odd denial for PP Gate. Now, like I said, this is RawStory.com. I was never even in the room for that period of time. What the fuck does that mean?
See, this is, you know, I mean, these kinds of things, you know, these kinds of things happen daily, and they're happening so often that all of us are, it can get to a point where that you actually start to not want to actually reason every incident that you hear, because it's so insane.
It's insane.
It's so absolutely insane. And see, and so what I'm wondering is, if there amongst the ruling class, I'm wondering if there is infighting going on. And that's where I'm trying to assess whether or not that's what we're witnessing, because I can't yet logically figure out what's taking place right now, other than the usual is obviously white supremacy continues on, imperialism continues on, and as you said before, Africans, indigenous people, we are still in the same position, so it really doesn't change for us whether, you know, this system is spinning out of control. The same people who've been in power continue to be in power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I don't know, man. You know, as a final question, you know, without being redundant, I mean, really, we have the Uhuru movement down in Florida. You know, they're still going with their thing. They seem to be the only organization that stays up, impedem, and so on. You know, what else is happening out here that you could direct the listeners to? In terms of resources, because, you know, I was out recently and someone asked me what was a good news resource, a reliable news resource, well, and I couldn't give them one.
Well, I would definitely agree with you. I think the Burning Spear, which is the publication of the African People's Socialist Party, the Burning Spear has been around. My God, I want to see, the Burning Spear has been around for at least about 30 years.
Almost.
And
yeah,
so the Burning, yeah, right. And so the Burning Spear has always remained solid. Their perspective is, if you want a solid materialist understanding of what's taking place, and we haven't even got into the whole black consciousness nonsense. But you know, and that's the thing that burns me the most about that whole thing is that, you know, black people are completely unaware of organizations like the African People's Socialist Party, publications like the Burning Spear. They're not aware of, you know, of all these other entities that are out there. I've done some work with the Black is Back Coalition, which is a coalition of black progressive organizations. And they're throughout the country, but I was doing work in New York. They're connected to the People's Democratic Uhuru Movement as well, which is the mass wing of the African People's Socialist Party. So I think people should definitely look those people up. Look up blackisback.org. Look up Uhuru. Look up APSP. And definitely, if only, you know, to politically educate yourself, because I find that even folks who are quote unquote activists and engaged and involved with things don't have a basic political understanding and can't really engage you from a non-idealistic standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's what I, you know, again, I concur, you know, I feel that is a serious, serious problem that once, you know, you start getting into personalities and, you know, they identify so much with a particular ideology, it's like, well, if it's outside of that realm, I'm just simply going to reject it. I'm simply not going to accept it. And you can't move forward like that. You can't even see what your possibilities are under those conditions. And, you know, Malachi, you know, as usual, thank you for, you know, taking the time to sit in with us, and you know, I really appreciate it. And is there any social media out there that you're working on, any other projects that people might be interested in?
Well, no, brother. Thank you for having me on. This was kind of spur of the moment.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you having me on. You know, I mean, I'm going through my own personal struggles at the moment, as we all are. But I hope I did, you know, offer something constructive to the game. But I would say before I sign off, to kind of connect to what I was just saying, is please seek out these organizations, whether it be the African People's Socialist Party, and they have a pretty decent presence on social media now. They're on Twitter. They're on Facebook. As a matter of fact, one of the things I love that the African People's Socialist Party has done recently is that they're broadcasting many of their forums live. The chairman of the African People's Socialist Party does a live political education, I believe, every Sunday. And you can, you know, you can catch that live on Facebook. You can see that on YouTube. And again, even if you don't go and join Uhuru or the African People's Socialist Party or blackisback.org, or Black is Back, rather. Go get your education. You know, don't assume just because you're a social media all-star and that you've got a couple of degrees under your belt that you actually have a revolutionary political understanding or a material political understanding, which is very important, you know, and for the folks who are caught up in this black consciousness movement, the folks who are leading you and pulling you into this, they ought to be ashamed, you know, and not to say that none of these people have anything to offer. But clearly, this is the same old pimp game, unfortunately. This is the same pimp game, because these people want to be the superstar Negro that everybody refers to. But to be quite honest with you, they don't really have the chops. And what's even worse than not having the political and intellectual chops, they don't have the principles. They don't have the principle. These folks are revealing themselves to, worst of all, not really have the principles that it takes to actually want to serve the people, you know, and that should be clear to folks.
Okay, man, thanks, you know, for those words of direction, I should say, because it is a discussion that needs to go further. And we're going to have to be able to, you know, finish this at another time. So thank you,
right, absolutely.
Brother Daniels. Peace to you. And thanks, everyone, for sitting in with this. This is The Angry Indian. Please stay tuned.
This is Samantha Nock at Samiri on Twitter, a halfbreedsreasoning.wordpress.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is why I love calling into the program, because the other day, Monday's show, Angry, were like, ooh, that show was smoking. I listened to most of it as much as I could because my phone kept ringing. And I don't have the patience to listen to the podcast. But listening to podcasts, I wish I have all the podcasts ready for me to listen to. It's just, yeah, when am I going to have that kind of time? But your angry takes his anger to a whole nother level. But what I loved about it, when he was talking about being that guy that white people feel comfortable with, that, you know, and they have these conversations. And I'm, even though I'm dark skinned, before I got all angry black women on people, because, you know, I'm one of those intelligent Negroes, I know that feeling where, you know, everybody kind of focuses, you know, white people feel safe and asking you, you know, to ask a Negro question. And they're just amazed that you can actually speak in complete sentences. Do you know how annoying that shit is?
My name is Nicholas Soames. I'm the Member of Parliament for Mid Sussex, and I am the grandson of Winston Churchill. I've decided to lend my strongest possible support to this campaign because I am appalled by the dishonesty and the disgraceful way in which the British National Party have used Churchill's name, particularly during the European election, where they used his face, his features, his words as promotional literature, trying to pretend that Churchill would have admired and supported the aims of the British National Party. What they have done is not only dishonest and irresponsible, but it's downright misleading to try and pretend that Churchill would have had any sympathy with the British National Party, whatever. He would, I can assure you, have loathed everything that they stand for. Churchill led a national government. He was acutely conscious, as Britain's war leader, of the need to have a national government to bring all parties together. And yet what the BNP seek to do is to divide all parties, to bring division and upset and lack of coherence to our communities by driving wedges between people. That is the exact opposite of everything that Churchill wanted to do in the national government. This is a peaceful country, and what they bring for it is uncertainty, fear and confusion. There is absolutely nothing that is British about the BNP.
Nothing British is a campaign against racism and extremism. Add your voice by signing our petition at www.nothingbritish.com.
Go on, chillin'. That's what we're talking about. We need a little help. Can't do this y'all alone. Thank God for this. Lynn, Jim Brown, y'all. Yes, this your evening. One more time. We're the ask one of children for get up. Get into it. Get involved. All 100 children, when I have to come down here to the Gullah Geechee Nation, and so glad that 100 to tune in to we Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio Station. 100 children know this your the head, fund the body of this your nation and the whole of we station. Queen Quest. Come on, chillin'. Get involved. Get involved. Get involved to the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition, the sponsor of this year's radio station. Honey, chillin', this year the we show. Gullah Geechee, Rhythm Radio. Come on, y'all.
In articles acknowledging the one-year anniversary of the assault on Gaza, blunt and unsparing language is rare. Despite sympathy and support for the Palestinian people, the description of what took place in January 2009 is sometimes buffered by a misguided sense of political correctness. Yes, it's terrible. Yes, it is unjust. But we don't want to be inflammatory or risk offending the sensitivities of those who, through their own willful ignorance, cling to the notion that Israel is a victim state, fighting for its very survival. This commentary is more forthright. Gaza, in plain language. The sociopathic Zionist administration of Israel, as part of its continuing brutal colonization of Palestine, deliberately devastated the already nearly incapacitated infrastructure which supports the existence of 1.5 million refugees. The people of Gaza, second, third, and fourth generation dispossessed Palestinians, are living in forced exile from land their families inhabited and cultivated for generations. Half of them are children under the age of 15. Their culture and their economy has been systematically ravaged by Israel for decades, and since 2006, a criminal siege, supported by the United States, as well as much of the international community, has deprived them of all but the most minimal resources for subsistence. This oppressed and brutalized population was bombed, bulldozed, and terrorized mercilessly for 23 days. What follows is a small sampling of facts concerning the barbaric actions which one of the most powerful military machines in the world took against a captive and defenseless population. If the reality presented here goes beyond the stretch of your imagination, you can verify the data yourself with a few simple Google searches. Though you'd better hurry, much of this information seems to be disappearing down Google's memory hole, just as is the fate of the people of Gaza. You may discover that exact figures vary somewhat depending on the source. But whether it was 21,000 structures or 22,000 structures destroyed, whether 280 schools were destroyed or badly damaged versus 230, the overwhelming truth of the physical devastation which took place in Gaza and the fact that this destruction was deliberate and premeditated is irrefutable. Even the Goldstone Report, itself a document with severe pro-Zionist overtones, issued by a declared Zionist and a supporter of Israel, states, unequivocally, the deliberate actions of the Israeli forces and the declared policies of the government of Israel cumulatively indicate the intention to inflict collective punishment on the people of the Gaza Strip in violation of international humanitarian law. We've heard, time and again, that more than 1,400 Palestinians were killed, over 80% of them civilians, including 342 children. These figures have become a familiar talking point in discussions of last year's assault, so much so that they may have lost their impact. But what we are not often reminded of is the horrific level of carefully planned destruction of civilian infrastructure in Gaza, orchestrated by Israel during Operation Cast Lead. Financed and armed by the United States, the Israeli military destroyed 15% of the structures in Gaza, approximately 22,000 buildings, including 5,300 housing units, destroyed or subject to major damage. Another 52,000 homes received some form of structural damage. Over 200 factories and 700 stores and businesses were destroyed or badly damaged. Of the residences, factories, and businesses completely destroyed, 1,300 of the homes and approximately 25% of the commercial property were deliberately and painstakingly bulldozed or exploded by Israeli ground forces. 8 hospitals and 26 primary health care clinics were damaged or destroyed. More than 280 schools were damaged or destroyed. water and sewage treatment facilities, as well as electricity infrastructure, were deliberately targeted, leaving vast segments of the population with little or no power or clean water for the duration of the assault and for weeks and months to follow. Massive amounts of agricultural lands were systematically bombed or bulldozed.
When the Israelis invaded the Gaza Strip, they came straight in here. I've covered earthquakes, hurricanes, and the tsunami. And what has happened here is as bad or worse than anything I've seen in any of those. And this was done by Israeli bulldozers.
Some estimates suggest that as much as 80% of the arable land in Gaza has been ruined or declared off-limits to the people of Gaza over the last decade. 2 million liters of wastewater from Gaza City's sewage treatment plant, bombed during the assault, leaked into surrounding agricultural land, making it unusable. An Israeli television station boasted that Israeli warplanes alone, without accounting for tank, ground troop, and warship ammunition, dropped approximately 1,000 tons of bombs on Gaza during Operation Cast Lead. The effort involved months, if not years, of carefully considered target selection, giving the lie to any claim that the devastation was incidental.
We are trying to avoid any kind of civil casualties.
Zaitun, also flattened by Israeli bulldozers. But in this house, they'd herded 100 members of the Samuni clan, and then they shelled it, killing 49 of them.
We are trying to avoid any kind of civil casualties.
It requires a stunning level of denial and self-delusion to pretend that the destruction which was achieved in Gaza had anything to do with Israel's security or the targeting of Hamas militants. This was savage and barbaric collective punishment unleashed on a civilian population, nothing less. Any suggestion to the contrary must be sharply and immediately ridiculed as absurd. This was arguably the first aerial bombing campaign ever conducted on a defenseless civilian population held captive within a fenced enclosure and not allowed to escape the assault. It is a measure of the cynical mindset of the Israeli military that leaflets were sometimes dropped in neighborhoods about to be bombed, suggesting the residents flee. We are about to destroy your home. You had better get out. Flee to where? Gazans are not allowed to leave their open-air prison, not even when under attack. This tactic on the part of Israel also gives the lie to the claim that homes and buildings were targeted because there were Hamas militants hiding inside them. Why then warn them to leave before destroying the structures? Given this litany of horror and the coldly premeditated nature of its execution, we must ask, what kind of society condones this level of brutality? What precedent is there for such monstrous disregard for the basic tenets of human decency? Unfortunately, we need look no further than the behavior of the United States, Israel's staunch supporter and mentor. In Iraq, the toll of U.S. militarism is well over 1 million lives, and a large part of the infrastructure of a nation of 26 million people has been ruined. And what of Gaza today, 1 year later? Israel's continued illegal siege, enabled by the United States and the U.S. client state, Egypt, has prevented any substantial amount of building material from entering Gaza. Essentially, no reconstruction has been possible. The people of Gaza live amidst the rubble created by Israeli hatred and aggression. They are attempting to rebuild their communities using mud bricks and whatever can be salvaged from the wreckage. The next time someone argues Israel has a right to defend itself or attempts to use the abusive spouse defense, look what you made me do.
They are forcing us to kill their children to defend our children.
Tell them no. Tell them there can never be any acceptable justification for the deliberate devastation of an entire society. It is unconscionable. It is wrong. Plainly put, there is no sane argument in favor of such behavior. Those who believe there is should be rebuked and must be vigorously opposed.
You can't bring up, one guy sent me a very interesting thing about Barack Obama and race. You can't bring up anything other than that suddenly he's African-American. If you start to, you know, delve around the edges of, wait a minute, isn't he mixed race? Weren't we told that last year, or whatever, biracial? not allowed to say that anymore. Apparently, the mainstream media has dubbed him to be African-American.
Yeah, I was driving in today, and I was seeing, because I saw this piece with him on 60 Minutes, and I thought to myself, he's very white in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, gee, can I even say that? Can I even say that without somebody else starting a campaign saying, what does he mean he's very white? He is. He's very white.
When a Muslim without a birth certificate has taken over the White House, you need a good white former junkie to show you the direction that America needs to go in. Beck, it's What's for Demagogue.
This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a Listen Live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio, a nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
Would you like to hear the lie that judges tell jurors every day?
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
In a criminal case, the judge instructs the jury, you decide the facts, but you jurors must apply to those facts the law as I explain it. And if the prosecution has proven the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must return a verdict of guilty. The problem with this instruction? It's not true. It's not true at all. And the judge well knows that, but most jurors don't. Jury nullification, the right of jurors to say no, to just say no to a prosecution, was central to the Bill of Rights. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson famously believed that jurors' right to nullify was central to democracy. Writing in the Champion magazine recently, criminal defense attorney Patrick Barone cautions that care must be taken when considering nullification because juries can use that authority to enhance and augment the power of the elite rather than to limit it. But, Barone continues, jury nullification can and should be a critical limitation on legislatures bent on promulgating and judges bent on enforcing ever more overreaching criminal laws. The take-home lesson here, criminal juries should know of their right to nullify because that power can constitute liberty's last defense.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union because freedom can't defend itself.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. What country comes to mind when you hear the following? Protesters confined to fenced-in so-called free speech zones. The government illegally spying on citizens and producing phony news reports. People imprisoned without charge or access to a lawyer. Prisoners tortured and killed. And an illegal war launched on the basis of lies in which illegal weapons are used against civilians, journalists, and hospitals. We like to think of countries other than our own when we think of such crimes being committed. But the responsibility to call a halt to such abuses of power always lies with the citizens of the government involved. In this case, that is to say, with us, whether we like it or not. The United States Constitution contains a remedy for such abuses so central to our system of checks and balances that it appears in that document 6 times. That remedy? Impeachment. Our duty is to demand it from our members of Congress. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Listen to Angry Indian Radio. He is not only for
Indians, but he was also for blacks and other minorities. And they have done a lot on the problems in Palestine and also the problems of blacks. And so I recommend that you listen to him.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
We are the Ku Klux Klan. We hate niggers, we hate Jews, we hate faggots, and we hate specs. We don't have to have a reason to hate. People need to get off your ass and wake up. This is America.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
This ends our news flash.
Joined here with journalist and Black Lives Matter activist Allison Pointer. Allison, could you tell us a little bit about the night of the Dallas shooting?
Well, I was with my friend. We were finished marching downtown and Main Street.